Welcome back, Warrior Next Door listeners. Hopefully you've had a chance to listen to episodes 1 and 2, where you would have heard what it was like for Marta Warner to be a young girl growing up in Nazi Germany, where the Nazi Party took control of pretty much every aspect of their lives. Well, in this episode, episode 3, we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk directly to how the war affected Marta and her family. In this episode, the war comes to them in Frankfurt, Germany, as the Allied bombing campaign sends these 1,000 bomber raids to just decimate the German cities. You're going to hear a first-person account of what it was like to be a citizen on the ground during one of these raids. So in this first clip, Marta's going to describe some things that you can only know if you've been there. Listen in.
With the bombings that occurred on a continued basis now, our school got hit. And when they let us out of the cellar,
the bomb shelter?
Yeah. Luftschutzkeller. What do you say? Bomb shelter. Okay, that's good.
Good job.
We kids ran, sorry. Needless to say. Okay, we trampled each other to death, literally. Physically, literally, you know, trying. If somebody fell down, that's tough shit. Sorry about that. You know, you go. You don't have time to think. All you have time for is trying to survive. And that is, again, you got to experience that in order to understand it.
I just want to give people a timeline. She's living in Frankfurt at this time. She's going to school there. Her family's from Frankfurt. They have a business there. Okay. And when she talks about experiencing bombing, the bombing effort in Frankfurt really didn't happen in earnest based on my research until really 1944. There were some attempts in 42, but they weren't particularly successful. The Germans still had control of the skies. Our bombing efforts weren't effective. So I'm going to hazard a guess that what she's the time frame that she's speaking to right now that you're about to hear a series of clips from was from 1944, when the British and the Americans finally had enough control of the sky and were preparing for D-Day, and what happened after D-Day as the U.S. armies on June 6, 1944, you know, basically pushed to the east to really start to hammer some of these cities like Frankfurt. So, Ryan, go ahead. We're going to play several of these clips uninterrupted so the audience can get a flavor for how hellish this was.
All right, here we go.
You have to think in terms of the bombings. You hear the swish of the falling bomb. You don't know exactly where it's going to hit, but by the sound, you know whether it's close or further away. Okay? They dropped what we call Brandbomben, which were bombs that ignited during the falling. So they came down as fire. So this way, the fire was initiated immediately. Okay? So everything was burned. You really have to live through that to even get a glimpse of what your feelings are. Because when you run through the heat at the smell and the broken glass, at the swishing of the bombs and the explosions, you don't think. Your brain does not work the way it normally does. All it wants for you is to survive whatever way you can. You know, so, and it does not compare with a soldier with a soldier in battle. He's in battle. He doesn't know whether or not he's going to get hit. But he's not running. He is advancing and he's shooting, okay? And he's got a mindset of getting that enemy. In this case, in those bombings, you don't have any of that. Like us at that age, having had the training in your ILDMC grunts, okay, there is just no way of telling anybody how you feel. Because at this point, I didn't even know myself. You know, was Hitler, did he have anything to do with that? Of course not. From what we are being told in the news, what we've been told in school, you know, it's all the others that do that to us. We had nothing to do with that. See what I'm getting at?
I do.
We are being persecuted for nothing at all. We got out, you know, through the glass and the bombs and the fire and the burnings and the everything. And during one attack, we were Eisenheimer Tor, and we wound up in a basement there. And during this attack, they brought a woman down the cellar stairs who had broken open and part of her intestinal drain was dragged behind her, you know, as they dragged her down the stairs. I remember that. She was dead. I mean, it was a corpse. Mm-hmm. She got caught while she was still outside. Mm-hmm. So I'll always remember that, the way they dragged that corpse down the stairs and the half of the gut dragging behind her.
I mean, when you saw these bombs dropping and you were a young woman, a teenager, a girl.
Yes.
I mean, and you're being evacuated, you're on trains, you're being moved around. Basically, all the trappings of civilization was collapsing.
Wasn't there.
Yeah, so how did you process that as a girl?
You don't.
Yeah.
Because you don't think. Mm. I told you, survive. Mm. And that is the only thing that matters at that point. You don't think about tomorrow, yesterday, or whatever. Right now is the only thing that matters. Mm. Right now, this moment is how you survive. Mm. That's it. Mm. There's nothing else there. And you got to experience that to truly get the feeling how that works. You know.
Yeah.
We have more clips to play, but we need to just pause here for a second to kind of peel some things back. From what I've read, there was about 127,000 tons of bombs that were dropped at Frankfurt in 1944 and 1945. And this is some of what the people on the ground would have experienced, Ryan. Ryan, can you imagine? So at this time, she would have been, 13 years old? 13, 14 years old?
Yeah, that's right.
Right? So could you imagine being that young and seeing the things that she just explained to us about the girl being dragged downstairs and her intestines hanging out on the ground?
I mean, who knows what she's seen up to this point, too. You know?
But, totally.
But yeah, I mean, this is not something fit for any child's eyes, you know. And, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I mean, you know, Tony and I are sitting here whenever we were, you know, interviewing her. And I'm doing this again now. My mouth's open listening. You know, I'm yep. enthralled with the things she says and, you know, what she's endured. To talk to someone who is at the business end of what we were doing, of what our pilots and our Air Force was doing and the Allies were doing. I mean, look, I mean, unfortunately, I mean, as they all say, war is hell and people, yeah. good people are caught up in it. It's really tragic how all that plays out and the impact that it has on people for generations, you know? So that's really all I've got to say.
I'll just add a few more and then we'll play some more clips from this. But she talks about the whooshing of the bombs. These are 500 to 1,000 pound bombs.
I can't imagine that.
No, no, you can't. You can't.
I mean, and think of the sound of all of them. It's not like just one's coming in.
Yeah, because by 1944, we were putting like 1,000 bomber raids in the air. And we had complete air supremacy. And so they would have felt the full effect of that. She talked about the fires, the incendiaries. We talked about napalm being used in the Pacific with the Ira Bewley podcast episode. Yeah. And when we talked about that, we said it was initially used in Europe first. It was tested there. And then those results were brought over to Asia for, you know, bombing Tokyo and whatnot. So we're talking about napalm, you know, huge, thousands of gallons of burning fiery gel landing on these cities and these people that you can't wipe off. And then these little, you know, these little pellets of phosphorus, you know, yeah, that would land and burn. And if you poured water on it, it burned more. So, yeah. I mean, so what ended up happening in these next few clips is she did have some relatives outside of the city. And for a time she was living out there, and then she'd go back to the city, and then eventually she would end up moving away. But let's play these next few clips so you can hear a little bit more about that, what she experienced, continued to experience, but this time kind of being evacuated from the immediate area.
And then started the bombings. And with that, the government decided that the children needed to be protected. So we were not going to stay in those towns. And they sent us into the villages someplace. And our classroom was sent to a little village called Burggemünden, which was in Vogelsberg. Mind you, at this point in time now, the majority of the men are playing soldiers someplace. So the villages are minus manpower. So they send us kids into the villages, and we could pick the potatoes out of the field. You know what I mean? They got free labor. At that point in time, being in a village was good because there was food. You know, things changed. Air raids is something you get to experience, the whole beauty of it. Mm. When the alert sirens blew, you know, you went to shelter, you know. And my father and I would go into our backyard and we would look in the sky at night to see the plane. And if there was a full moon, if there was light, you could see the formation of the planes, you know, and they were like this. They were always, but the whole formation was in a triangular, and they would drop the bombs. The first would drop, and the next one would drop, and the next one would drop, you know, and we could watch because we were at the outskirts of the city, so we could watch. Unless it hit us, you know, that was a different story. When it came close enough, we'd get hide. So, while I was in Burggemünden, one day I got sick, really sick. And there was no doctor in that village. There was a doctor in the village Niedergemünden, which was several kilometers away. And I really got sick. And my teacher put me on her bicycle and took me to the next village where there was a doctor. Well, as it turned out, he did have a telephone and he called Gießen or whatever, but they did come with an ambulance and took me, and I had an appendectomy. And during the surgery, in the beginning of that surgery, there was an air raid, and I woke up from the anesthesia in an elevator. Oh. And the surgeon was standing next to me, and on his hands was a towel. I will always remember that. And a nurse saw me while I was moving and looking. I was going to start talking, I guess. And she put the mask back on my face again and dribbled ether.
So you woke up during the air raid when the procedure...
During the surgery, during an air raid in an elevator.
Oh my goodness.
These things... Well, they're happening now in certain places of the world, but for a long time, we didn't think they'd happen again. I mean, so she goes out to the village where she has a front row seat to Frankfurt, getting absolutely shellacked. She talks as a girl about seeing the beauty of it. And I guess there would be kind of a can't turn your head away from the train wreck sort of beauty to it. And then she gets sick in this village and they got to bring her back in the town. And they're doing an appendectomy on her, which is a kind of risky procedure in 1944, yeah, without antibiotics, during an air raid, with ether being played on a mask. I mean, you see anesthesiologists now when you get your tooth pulled are more sophisticated than putting ether and a rag on your face. And that's what they were doing as she came out of this on the elevator during the air raid.
So, first of all, I mean, the bombings at night, obviously she was watching the British bombers because they bombed at night. We bombed during the day.
Yep.
Then I assume that this appendicitis happened during the daytime. I don't know, but she ends up on an elevator. Now, what I'm curious about, did they seek shelter in the elevator or did the power go out while they're in the elevator? What a scary place to be when there's bombs going on because of something, of a piece of shrapnel cuts that elevator cable,
yeah,
you're yeah, going down.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that. Oh, go ahead.
Well, no, that was it. It's just that, you know, she had the triple whammy there with all that. You know, I mean, she was on an trapped on an elevator with the power out, a bomb raid going on, and then she comes to. You know, during it, it's just amazing, fact that she remembers it to this day. You know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things when we're that young that burn really hot, and she's prime time for that. She's 13, 14 years old at this time. And oh my gosh. I mean,
you know, I'd be curious to know, like, if there's like a doctor listening or someone who's a nurse, you know, ether, I suspect is not used anymore, you know, compared to the anesthesia we have today, but maybe ether wore off too quick. Maybe that was the reason why she came to so quickly, is that maybe it doesn't linger long enough. And if you stop dripping the ether, you'll come right out of it, you know? And I wonder if that's what happened because she seemed to remember it vividly.
Yeah, especially if you're not in the operating room anymore because of an air raid while you were under and they're trying to get you to a safer place and you come to on the elevator. I mean, those sort of things are, you know, you're probably not going to be able to maintain your standard operating procedures when that happens. So that was, I mean, it got so bad that ultimately the family had to really evacuate. And what you're going to hear next is another odyssey that a lot of Germans went through where family members were needed for the war effort elsewhere. A lot of the big cities weren't safe. There were factories being built all over the occupied Third Reich, not just in Germany, but outside of it. And families were being moved all around. While all this was happening, while the U.S. and the British Air Force were just mollywhopping anything that moved on the ground. So this next series of clips is going to talk about, you know, her moving away from this area because of the war.
Mollywhopping?
Well, I was going to say, what, cod wallop? Or cod dollop? Molly wop, at any rate.
Because of his profession and ability, he was not in, not playing soldier. They kept him because he was working in a weapons factory. Okay. So they transferred that particular weapons factory to Silesia, Halba near Sagan in Silesia, which is now Polish, then was German. Yeah, right. Mother, I was in Burgemünden, and my brother was, my father and mother had my brother taken to my mother's half-sister in Thüringen. And my mother was traveling from Frankfurt to see her children and her husband all over Germany.
Wow. So the whole family was broken up.
Yes.
You were living in a village. Your father was working in a weapons plant.
In Silesia, yeah. And my brother was in Thüringen. And my mother was in Frankfurt.
Wow.
While she was trying to visit any one of us, there was an attack on the train, and she got hit.
Oh.
And she got in her, hit in the right arm. And she was eventually taken to Gießen, the first hospital. And they got my father. They wanted to amputate, and he refused. Mm. At that time, again, you have to remember the time and the way society still was, da-da-da-da. The husband would not have his wife's arm amputated. Mm. Okay. So they took her from Gießen to Silesia. And I'm still in Burgemünden at that point in time. And my brother is still in Thüringen. And because of her injury, my father then got the authorization to get his children to where they were. And they got what was called the Helfsheim, which were shacks that were built on the forest edge. Mm. You know, at the edge of the forest. Mm-hmm. There was a little brook. That was a nice place, by the way. It was a kitchen with two bedrooms.
Okay.
It was a big kitchen in the middle and a bedroom on each side and an outhouse out there in the woods. Mm. Oh, and there's one other thing about that place. I'll always remember because there was no water. Mm. But over at the other edge, a little way away, there was an old farmhouse. Mm. Now we are in way East Germany or Polish, whatever. Now it's Polish then, okay? And one of the things that I'll always remember, that roof of that house was straw. Mm. I mean, I come from a city, remember?
Yep.
Initially, originally. So that was something really weird. And in this old farmhouse lived these two old people in this one room together with the chickens and the pig. Mm. This one room, it had a stove in it and it had a bed in it. And I remember the old man sitting at the window using the curtain to wipe his knife. And the old woman would sweep that floor. Because, you know, and that was the end of it. Hello there. They had chickens and whatever, but they had a pump outside, water. And my parents had made a deal with these people, and we were allowed to get the water. So my mother would send me with two buckets, a wooden thing in which you could hang on two buckets, to get the water. Hmm. And I'd go to the pump and pump the two buckets and come home with two buckets of water. And one day this old lady came to our house, and she opened her apron, and she had at least a dozen eggs in there she gave to my parents. Mm. I mean, that was, hello! Yeah. That was something out of this world and wonderful. So I remember that, that old lady and that house and that water, getting that water. And I remember that outhouse because, oh boy, I was so scared at night.
Wow.
Dude, the things we take for granted, right? I mean, fresh eggs, running water, right? I mean, I probably have eggs every morning, don't think anything of it. But how many times have we interviewed someone who fought in the war and didn't have any eggs or lived off powdered eggs or whatever? And some of the things that the vets or people who had to survive off the food that wasn't available to them during a war, they seem to go after the fresh milk, ice cream, eggs. Those seem to be the things that you hear come up over and over again.
Yeah, they were essentially delicacies. And at that time, whenever everything was rationed so much, not only overseas, but even here in the U.S., you know, we've talked about the rationing that's happened and everything here. Having eggs, having dairy products and everything was a hot commodity.
And what a culture clash. So she was a city girl in what was a prosperous, very progressive, forward-thinking, you know, country, Germany.
Yeah.
And now because of the war, that city and everything she knew and took for granted was getting the holy hell bombed out of it. Mm-hmm. Now she's living in basically what is today Poland. And she's describing the locals there living a very different lifestyle with like the thatched roofs and the chickens running around in the house.
The house. If I understand, so she went from Frankfurt, so basically being the west side of Germany.
Yep.
They've been moved all the way to the opposite side of Germany, okay? Yep. And what was eastern side of Germany. Today it's Poland, as she said a few times. But was that for her to go to school? Why were they moved, or were they actually fleeing?
That's a great question, and we need to keep things into context here. So her father was working in a weapons factory in Poland that the Germans have built. I've tried to research what that weapons factory is, and I can't find it. But there was one there, and because of all the bombings in Frankfurt, for a while, her mom, who is like superhuman, we're going to get into her more in a little bit.
Yeah,
had like a son here, the daughter in the village, a husband in Silesia. Well, finally, they were able to get the entire family into Silesia with her father. So on these clips you just heard, it's about the family being separated because of the bombings in Frankfurt where they lived, and then reunited in Silesia where her father was working in a factory. And her mom you're going to hear more about this too later, got really horribly wounded. She's going to get shot in the arm. She basically got strafed on a train by an Allied fighter, probably a P-47, probably a 50 caliber bullet. And for those who don't know what a 50 caliber bullet is, it's a really large bullet. I mean, it's the bullet that comes out is the size of a grown man's thumb. And when it hit her arm, it damaged it so bad that they wanted to amputate it and they wouldn't let her do it. And
I think that it must have been shrapnel or something that hit it. Because if that bullet had hit her arm, it probably would have been taken off.
So it could have been shrapnel from it. Whatever it was, the plane got strafed and something hit her arm bad enough that caused it that they wanted to amputate and they didn't. And so that's going to have ramifications for what's going to happen next.
So I was just going to say this weapons factory in Silesia, she mentioned the town of Sagan, which is where Stalag Luft III was. You know, Harold Dunn, that series, The Great Escape, took place in this very same part of the country, actually. So just a little bit of a, you know, link there.
No, you nailed it, dude, because when I was doing research on it, they had like on the Google map, you know, the Stalag Luft III memorial sites and all this stuff. And, you know, this is speculation, but one of the things that the Germans used a lot of during the war is slave labor. There was a lot of Russians that were in a lot of these prisoner of war camps. They were literally worked to death. I mean, well over a million Russians, POWs, perished in captivity, often because of slave labor. And I'm wondering, I don't know for sure if maybe there was some weapons plant that was utilizing that labor force there.
Well, didn't we find out from the Harold Dunn series that part of the reason why the Russians were treated so horribly and suffered so badly as a prisoner is because they were not part of the Geneva Convention.
Yeah.
So the Germans could just do whatever they wanted with the Russians, you know?
And they did, and they didn't feel there's any lost honor. And not only that, but the Russians were seen because of being communist, and the Nazis were antithetical to that. They were seen as being just a lesser version of a human being for even being part of a system like that. So you had all these things that were creating the conditions for the Germans and the Nazis to really play a war of annihilation with each other. So at any rate, I digress a bit on the weapons plant, but you're absolutely right. It was by the Stalag Luft 3 POW camp, and I just wonder if that association is not just happenstance. So the way she talks about it at this point in the interview, it sounds like things are going pretty good, right? I mean, yeah, their city got bombed, they're at war, but they're in this area, it's relatively peaceful, they're getting fresh eggs and milk, they're getting to know the neighbors. Well, now you're going to hear next series of clips how the proverbial crap hit the fan.
Then the Russians came. Meaning the progression of the fighting had come close, and they were coming, and they were we are being evacuated. They're evacuating the area. My brother is 8 or 9 years old or something like that. I'm in my early teens. My parents had got all of their belongings from Frankfurt to there. Now my father is with a shovel digging a huge hole to put all of his belongings into the hole, because the Russians are coming.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yep.
And we have to leave. So they take some sort of a bedspread type deal, sew it together, make it a rucksack for my mother on her back. Mind you, she's in a body cast with her arm cast like that. Mm-hmm. Okay? And we have to flee.
When you were in Silesia and you were in Eastern Germany and the Russians were coming, were they close enough that you could hear the fighting?
Yes.
What was that like? Do you, as a girl, and you're hearing this, it must have been frightening.
It sounded like fireworks. And that's why I do not see go to fireworks. I can't handle it. That's what it sounds like. The explosions, the shooting. Okay? And it comes closer. So you know you have to run.
I don't think there was any fear that the Germans had more than when the Russians were advancing in the east and they were really pissed off about what happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the German people were being told how subhuman and what sort of barbarians the Russians were. So the Germans were extremely afraid of the oncoming Russians. And you know what? They were true. All those things were true.
They should have been afraid, yes.
Yeah, so it's the one time when, whether it was, legit or not, the things that the German government told the people were actually turned out to be very true, you know, so.
It did, and she talks to her family, taking her belongings, digging a hole in the backyard and burying it. The Russians, it's well documented, as they advanced west, they took anything that wasn't bolted it down. They lashed it to their tanks. They mailed it home. They brought it home with them. You know, Russia was a the Soviet Union was a very poor country. I mean, mm-hmm. I've read Russian accounts of soldiers who, as they pushed west into Germany and got into Europe, and they saw these beautiful pastoral looking farms. It looked like paintings. And they were like, why are these people? Why did they invade us? We have nothing. Why did they come to where we are? Mm-hmm. Their existence is way better than what ours is, you know? Mm-hmm. And the other thing I thought was interesting is I sure would like to get a metal detector and go around Poland for a while. There's got to be a bunch of amazing stuff just buried everywhere, because they couldn't have been the only ones that did that.
I mean, you're right. I've thought about that a lot. You know, of all of the places in Europe, I mean, from France up to Holland and down over to, you know, even into Russia, whenever the Germans were invading Russia, you know, over to Stalingrad. Everybody was burying things all over the place, burying your money, burying your belongings, your jewelry. I mean, unless you were going to use it to barter with, which could have been the case, you know. But for the most part, I bet you there's, you know, couches buried in the ground all over the place over there.
Yeah, whatever they couldn't carry. And I think they had plans, hopefully, to go back someday and maybe retrieve it. But, you know, we know now that when the war ended, that would be behind the Iron Curtain, and they would never see Silesia again. And it's still not a part of Germany today. And so now in the next series of clips, Ryan, I mean, for all the crap that she's gone through, all the hellacious experience, the worst is yet to come.
Yeah.
We're about to play a series of clips about her having to be and her family evacuated. Now they're going back into Germany after they were evacuated out of Germany to be part of with her dad, to be part of the weapons plant program. And they were having this lifestyle that seemed to be okay. Now they're running from the Russians. So
if you think about this, so they're over by not far from where Stalag III is. We know from that series that the Russians liberated, basically those guys were force marched out of the camp in January of 45. Okay. Yep. That is when this would have been happening. You know, Correct. Obviously she would have been being moved at the same time that everyone else was getting out of Dodge, you know?
I'm glad you stopped us, Ryan, because—
Dead of winter.
Because we did the Brumbaugh series after we met with Marta, right? Or Harold Dunn, Harold Dunn, sorry. So for I got confused, but for our audience, Harold Dunn was someone who flew in— was it B-17s?
Yeah, he was a co-pilot on that mission that he got shot down
and
on.
And became a POW in Stalag III, which we already said was right in the area that Marta was in with her family. And they talk about this great evacuation out of this prisoner of war camp down into southern part of Germany. So, and they also talk about the refugees that they met along the way.
Yes.
And the horrible condition that the refugees had, and how the POWs and the refugees were kind of helping each other at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, and think about this also. Think about the Battle of the Bulge that was happening up in Belgium, in Luxembourg, how horrible the winter was. You know, all those countries over in Europe are like states here in the U.S. as far as their sizes go. And January 45, the Russians were coming. Stalag III was evacuated. Her family gets the heck out of there from the same very region. They're all trying to move. And this is one of the worst winters on record. You know, it's sub-zero Fahrenheit weather and lots of snow and wind. And here they are trying to grab what belongings they can and make their way back to the west. Sorry. Yeah.
This is the end of episode 3, but not the end of Marta's saga. It's amazing. What you just heard was Marta describe what it was like suffering these 1,000 bomber raids and then having to evacuate the towns, having her family separated, to be reunited briefly in the east where it was thought to be safer, only to have to evacuate as refugees as the Russians push in from the east to help defeat Nazi Germany. So in the next episode, episode 4, what we're going to learn is that being a refugee is, in many cases, worse than being a citizen in a town that's being bombed by 1,000 B-17s. The thing that I mentioned in the previous episode, and I'll reiterate it now, as we listen to Marta just explain her narrative. When you think things are going to get better, they just keep getting worse. And the next episode will be a tale of survival that I don't think many of us have can understand or have heard before. So at any rate, please join us for next week for episode 4. I think it'll be evocative and enlightening. So until then. Well, this is quickly becoming my favorite part to prepare for. It's the listener feedback portion. We love getting feedback from our listeners. As I mentioned in a previous episode, we do everything we can on Facebook to make sure that we answer any sort of comments or reply to any sort of comments that we receive. And so we have one recently from Josh Edwards, and he writes, "My wife's grandfather stormed the beach on Normandy like Bill Parker. As I mentioned before, he was someone that we featured in our previous episode." Josh continues, "I do not know much about his story because he passed before I had a chance to meet him. From what my wife has told me, he is like most veterans and didn't talk much about the war. I want to do more research into his military background, and listening to your podcast has given me the inspiration to do it." So we love it. We love all the feedback we get. Sometimes it's negative feedback. We like that as well. We want to make sure that we can correct some of the errors that we made, and we've made several. It's going to happen. But what I like about Josh's comment here is if we can encourage people or enable them in some way to do a little more research on some of their family members, whether it has to do with the history of World War II or something else, we think that's great. The co-founder of the show, Ryan Fairfield, has done an extensive amount of research on uncles and grandfather-in-laws and trying to basically collect their stories for posterity. And when he's done that, it's been deeply appreciated by his family. And Josh, I know if you're able to do that, your family will deeply appreciate that as well. So thank you very much for listening. And if anyone has any comments that they'd like to share, please do so. Or if it's just a story about someone in your family, when you listen to one of our episodes, maybe one of the experiences resonates with you and you want to share with us something that your family was a part of in that respect, we'll do everything we can to share it with our audience because, well, quite frankly, this audience kicks ass and it appreciates cool stuff like this. So until next week, ca-caw!